Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 28th of May, 2013. This would be Nav Briefing 67, and the title is Lydia's Vow. I don't know exactly where to begin with this briefing. The navigator, in his role as Nahual, has experienced quite a few adventure-filled days recently. I had the great privilege of a visit from a woman shaman of high accomplishment, such as they call a maestra, or a female master in the tradition of South America. And in the company of the shaman, this medicine woman, and her partner, and Kundri, who played the role of apprentice on this occasion, we went to Infinity Ridge on Saturday, the night of the full moon. I think I ought to register, both for now and for those in some future time who listen to this recording, that I'm speaking on the 19th day of the shift of Kematsu, this being formerly known as the double shift of Bhudevi, or Bhuvaneshvari, and the wrathful green Tara. I'm suggesting that the word Kematsu combines both these names, because Mat, the Egyptian goddess Mat or Ma'at, would have a close relation to Tara in her role as the selector. The full moon of the Kematsu shift occurred on Saturday night, and also on Sunday night, the moon was still completely full, and it was huge because it stood very close to its perihelion in the torso of the scorpion. Neither in the heart nor in the tail, but in the torso, the ecliptic degree being about 18 Sagittarius. For reasons that may become obvious in the course of this briefing, I want to record for all future time, as long as my words remain accessible via this recording, the particular conditions of that session on the ridge, followed by another event on Sunday, and this recording today. So, to be precise, there was a full moon on the 25th of May, 2013, in 4 degrees of Sagittarius, in the upper part of the scorpion, close to the heart star Antares. On the following day, Sunday the 26th, the moon reached its perihelion in 18 Sagittarius, that is to say, it had advanced from the head to the mid-torso of the scorpion. And today, the 28th of May, at sunset, at the moment, in fact, that I am speaking these words, the planets Venus, Jupiter, and Mercury conjoin at the southern horn tip of the bull, close to the star Alheka, which star, as I have often noted, is itself in close proximity to the Crab Nebula, a supernova remnant that exploded in 1054 AD and is widely considered to be the most mysterious celestial object in the sky. Those of you in the GNE know that the star Elheka, marking the tip of the southern horn of the bull, is associated with the Aeon Christos, and the Crab Nebula associated with the regenerative power of the Mesotes. While the star at the tip of the northern horn, El Nat, is associated with the Aeon Telete. Now, at this moment, there is that extraordinary conjunction visible just shortly before the rotation of the Earth causes those three bodies to sink below the horizon. They are not very far from the sun, so in order to see them, you must look, or you must have been looking, low on the horizon, near the place where the sun went down. So at best you get a subliminal glimpse, a fleeting subliminal glimpse of this marvelous conjunction. How strongly does this contrast to the celestial spectacle of March 2012? At that time, the attention of the whole world, not just amateur astronomers, but the entire world, went to the magnificent conjunction of Venus and Jupiter in the bull with the brilliant sight of the Pleiades involved. You will recall that event and how it signified the coming of the Hetaira, and the meeting of Venus and Jupiter signified the pleasure of guidance and the guidance of pleasure. Well, I can say that under this conjunction, this time, in May of 2013, 15 months later, there was another version of the meeting of Venus and Jupiter. And that was the meeting between a Pachamama medicine woman and the Nahual of Infinity Ridge. That meeting took place last week, and as I said, on Saturday, a small party of four sorcerers climbed to Infinity Ridge to perform a Gayan Tantric ritual. As it turned out, the Nahual could not perform that ritual at that moment, because it would have required waiting on the ridge longer than we were all prepared to wait that evening. The view from the ridge looking east does not provide a flat horizon for observing celestial events. In fact, what you see looking east is a huge mesa, a bluff. This is the altar of the vultures, and several families of vultures live on this bluff, which oversees Infinity Ridge. But because the bluff looms over the ridge, the horizon line is very high looking east. So whereas a star or a planet or the moon might cross the eastern horizon in this region early in the evening, or even just a little while after sunset, it would not rise behind the bluff for some 3 or 4 hours later. So, on that occasion, given those conditions, the moonrise would have been approaching midnight, I would guess. In consequence of these delicate conditions in the natural environment, the Gayan Tantric ritual designed itself in a particularly fascinating way this weekend. One thing I will say about the practice of Gayan Echo Sorcery or Planetary Tantra or Gayan Tantra, whatever you want to call it, one thing I would say to those in the future who take up these practices is that you have the occasion with every practice, with every particular ritual, to realize that the power of this tantra is so wild and outrageous that it cannot be controlled. But all the more so, it must be commanded with great finesse. No Gayan Tantric ritual can be performed in a pre-programmed or formulaic manner. So when I was on the ridge with the three other members of the Nawal's party on Saturday, this particular ritual designed itself in front of our eyes, designed itself with mudras, with thread, with the response of the mountains to the secret Dakini name of the planetary animal mother. And it designed itself with the collaboration of the vultures. In doing so, it became evident to the party of the Nahual on that day that the ritual must assume two parts. To be more specific, the intention of the rite could only be achieved at the moment when the moon crossed the horizon. Now, the moon rises, or appears to rise, because the earth is actually turning toward the body of the moon. The earth is rolling or rotating toward the orb of the moon, therefore causing the moon to appear to rise over the horizon. Now, the rate that the earth turns and spins eastward causes 1 degree of the ecliptic, 1 degree of the entire celestial sphere to rise over the horizon every 4 minutes. 1 degree every 4 minutes. 360 degrees times 4 minutes is 1,440 minutes. That's how many minutes there are in a day. The visible diameter of the moon is about 0.5 degree of the ecliptic. So it therefore follows that the moon will rise over any horizon line in about 2 minutes. So I had 2 minutes to perform this rite. 2 minutes to perform the critical act of this rite. The rite itself, like all rites in planetary tantra, involves a courting. And a courting, of course, cannot be done in 2 minutes. So as the rite unfolded, if it had been accomplished on Infinity Ridge, I would have done a courting in the Devi tree, and then come to a certain point in that courting, adding a certain element, of which I will not speak at this moment, a certain implement of magic. And that implement of magic then had to be situated in the courting relative to the earth in a precise way in those 2 fleeting minutes when the moon rose above the local horizon. So it was along these lines that this rite designed itself before our eyes, before this party of four on Infinity Ridge. But when I realized that we would have to wait too long for the moon to come up, I made the choice to complete the rite the following day from another place in the hills of Andalusia, up among the Evergardner oaks. From that vantage point, I would have a clear view of the Crestallina Mountains to the east, where I had a pretty good idea that the moon would be coming up on that evening, Sunday evening, May 26th. So I performed the rite on moonrise of that date, and that was also the date of a perigee surge of the moon in 18 degrees of Sagittarius, placing it in the torso of the scorpion. Now, you may be wondering, and you're a sorry, hopeless animal if you're not, just what was the intention of that rite? And it's my pleasure to tell you exactly what it was. Remember that in planetary tantra, which is the highest form of ritual magic on this planet, in Kali Yuga, and the only truly authentic and efficacious form of magic at all, in planetary tantra, everything is out in the open. There are no secrets and nothing is hidden. And so if I don't explain certain details about this rite, it's not because I'm holding something back. It's simply because I would prefer to describe those details at another time, in another context, when I can present the intel more comprehensively. But for now, right now, I can tell you exactly the intention of that rite. You know, some time ago, I gave a talk on Red Ice Creations, and I prefaced that talk. I tried to bait it a little bit and get people's interest and curiosity by putting out the word that it was my last interview. And I don't know if that worked. I don't know if I got any special attention or interest by using that little gimmick. But there was something that I said at the beginning of that interview that was also a gimmick or a tease or a test, if you will. When Henrik asked me what I was doing, I said that I'm orchestrating the fate of the human species. Now, why would I say such an arrogant and outrageous thing, apart from the fact that it's true? Well, I said it for effect, obviously. I wanted to see if I could get a rise out of anybody. And guess what? Although Red Ice interviews are widely circulated on the internet, and although they must have a considerable audience, not one single person wrote me asking me, in effect, "John, what in the fuck are you talking about? And who the hell do you think you are?" And so, what did I conclude from that? If I put out the message through a select internet or alternative channel to people who are supposedly awake or waking up, to people who are supposedly versed in certain matters of magic and metaphysics and sorcery and shamanism, if I put out the message to a purportedly intelligent and informed audience that I am orchestrating the fate of the human species and no one calls me on it, well, I conclude that they don't care who's running their attention. And so it is my intention to command the attention of the human species because they are too stupid, lazy, and narcissistic to command it by themselves. And I took the first step to do so this weekend. But I did it in a sly, indirect, and considerate way. After all, the Nawal has to be polite, because if I'm not polite, I really don't know what consequences might ensue. And so I politely framed the language of this rite. And this is how I framed it. I intend this rite into the endopsyche, the human subconscious, so that it turns the locked attention of human animals to the attraction magic of your medicine. Period. Now, if you listen to what I just said, you'll see that I am addressing it directly to Gaia Sophia, to the Aeon Sophia. At the end, I say, your medicine. So the syntax of the rite or spell, if you will, was an intentional syntax expressing exactly what I intended to do and addressing it to the Aeon Sophia. Of course, in performing the rite, I did not speak it out loud. Rather, I spoke the rite subvocally, and I conferred the intention stated in the rite upon the cording that I constructed to go along with the ritual. And at a certain moment, when the moon just appeared above the ridge of the Crestallina Mountains, I incorporated into that cording a particular feature that I have never used ever before. And that feature was part of the custom design of the cording, as it were, that would allow that cording to be fully effective. And that feature was connected with the protection of the intention. And it ensured the protection of the intention in a way that was required in this particular instance above and beyond the usual protection which pertains to a Gaian cording. Normally, I don't have to add protection. But when I was up there on the ridge in the party of the other sorcerers, and they are witness to what I'm saying now, because it all happened completely out in the open, they were following it word by word, gesture by gesture, and moment by moment. When I was up on the ridge, it occurred to me, through instruction that I received directly from the light at that moment, that I needed to add a non-syntactical twist to the syntax of the cording. And that is what I did by using this particular implement, which I hung on the string. And then, in the 2 minutes that the moon rose, after I had moistened the cord with my saliva, I positioned that implement in a particular way relative to the earth. And then after the 2 minutes passed, I had time to complete the cording, and I proceeded as usual by cutting the cording and releasing the intention into the cording. I intend this rite into the human subconscious so that it turns the locked attention of human animals to the attraction magic of your medicine. That is a Gaian tantric spell of intentional magic. I must say that it was a huge delight to perform this ritual. It was also a thrill. But it was a thrill that I felt in a serene way, in a sober and serene way, as I stood up there on the hillside in the coolness of the May evening, waiting for the moon to rise. And as I did so, I reflected on many, many things that had brought me to that moment, and on the many encounters and adventures that had prepared me to do what I did that evening. This is the first Gayan Tantric rite of its kind, and I want to describe to you exactly why it is the first. In the course of doing so, I'll come around to the subject of Lydia's vow and say a little more about what happened to that party of four sorcerers on Infinity Ridge. First of all, I just want to point out that in the syntax of this ritual, I sent the intention into the human subconscious. But how can I do that? How can I get an intention inserted into the subconscious of humanity in such a way that it would direct the first attention of the human race? In a way that I wish the first attention to turn. Specifically in this case, I wished it to turn toward the attraction magic of Sophia's planetary medicine. You know what that is, don't you? Her planetary medicine is the cornucopia or medicine basket of entheogenic plants. The syntax does not say, mind you, that I intend to turn the subconscious of humanity toward the planetary medicine itself. It says that I intend to turn it toward the attraction magic of that medicine. By directing that intention into the human subconscious, I plant in the subconscious what is called, or what might be called, a track. Just like I am recording a track here on this archonic device, GarageBand, I'm implanting a track in the human subconscious, which then operates according to the natural law of the subconscious, which is by entrainment and suggestion. So the subconscious operates to entrain and suggest the first attention. However, the first attention has a prompt function. So the first attention prompts the subconscious, which then in turn entrains the first attention. You didn't know that, did you? Well, I didn't know it myself until I just said it. But I know it happens to be absolutely true and verifiable. So by placing a track that carries a certain intention in the subconscious, at some moment when the first attention of any human animal accesses the subconscious, it can pick up that track and thereby be entrained in the direction indicated, that is to say, toward the attraction magic of Gaia's planetary medicine. See how beautiful and complex, how poetic and exquisitely sophisticated is the ritual syntax of Gaian Echo Sorcery. Now, to understand how I could do such a thing opens the mind to a fantastic mystery of the planetary animal mother. I call this mystery Gaia's golden seam. Remember that little jingle, that song, every cloud has a silver lining, right? Well, who knows? That could be possibly some kind of popular saying that arose that was by a long trickle-down effect from teachers in the mysteries. You could say that the cloud or the organic light has a silver lining, Gaia's golden seam. And what is a silver lining? Well, it actually is like a lining in the organic light. The organic light is full of many, many structures. But generally speaking, it has a porous, foam-like constitution, and it has the internal organization of chambers and massive fractalized facets and conicals. That is to say, places where information is stored. But in the entire structure of the organic light, there is a unique feature that may be compared to a seam that runs through the light. And you can picture this seam as a golden line, sort of like a zipper, a golden line with a scintillating steadiness to it. And on either side of this golden line, defining, as it were, the edges of the seam, is a thin margin of silver beading. So a golden seam with a margin of silver beading on each side. And this seam in the organic light is the place where Sophia holds her intentional syntax. Now, the entirety of the organic light is filled with wisdom. What else would you expect? It's filled with knowledge, with knowing. And human animals can access that knowledge and that knowing directly from the mind of the planetary animal mother. Clairaudiently, clairvoyantly, through touch, through taste, through all the senses. And it is possible to learn anything you want to learn and to delve deeply into all of the mysteries of the universe by conversing with the organic light. And as you know, in Not in His Image, I revealed something that was protected by a vow of silence in the ancient mysteries. That is to say, simply, what is our method? What's our method? How do we do it? How do we know what we know? How are we Gnostikoi, those who really know, those who do not merely speculate or think or believe or suppose, but those who really know? We are Gnostikoi by the method of instruction, by the organic light. But in the entire range of experiences available to the Teleste, there is one unique experience that exceeds them all, and it becomes available today. It is available now in Planetary Tantra. It is available in these 200 closing years of Kali Yuga. And that method, that experience, is access to the intentional syntax of the Wisdom Goddess. Now, her intentional syntax, which is like a seam in the organic light, is the place where the human animal can deposit its intention so that it becomes her intention. In other words, it is the circuit in the organic light that she makes available for human animals to command her. And so what I actually did by performing this Gayan Tantric rite was to command the planetary animal mother herself. And as I said a while ago, that is the highest desire of the Gayan Dakinis, and even of Savaya herself, that we human animals, we the luminous children of her dreaming, should command her by pleasure. So it was at my pleasure that I shared and demonstrated the first part of this rite to the sorcerer's party on the hill, and it was at my pleasure that I went alone to the other hill and completed the rite the following evening. Now, what else can I say to you in this moment and in this context about what I am calling the intentional syntax of the organic light, the intentional syntax of the living intelligence of the planet? What else can I tell you about that? It feels to me like I would really love to say two things about that. The first thing is that the golden seam in the organic light can be increased in the way that a vein of gold in the mountain would grow. Gold grows in the mountain. Gold grows. A vein of gold actually grows in rock. And likewise, like a vein of gold, this seam in the organic light can grow as it receives an attribution that comes from the human animal. And that attribution operates at the chemical level through argon. And so the presence of this seam in the organic light as a supernatural fact, a supernatural event, is reflected, if you will, in the natural world by the presence of argon in the atmosphere. And you might note that argon, which is called a noble gas, is present in the atmosphere to a higher distribution even than CO2, carbon dioxide. But the presence of argon in the terrestrial atmosphere is not fixed by any natural law. It has no particular or arbitrary limit. And in the total atmospheric dynamic, in the homeostasis of the atmosphere, there is a margin for the increase or accretion of argon. And what determines the accretion of argon building Gaia's golden seam? The human animal itself, and uniquely the human animal, produces this accretion of argon. And it does so by certain chemical effects of the process that is ordinarily called thinking. Now, the second thing I'd like to say is something that I said to the party on the ridge. It's wonderful to call ourselves the magical animals of the planetary animal mother, the magical children of the wisdom goddess, the luminous children of Sophia. It's wonderful to call ourselves that, isn't it? Because that's exactly what we are. And there is nothing else we can call ourselves that is more true or more beautiful than that. And you cannot become anything but more beautiful by calling yourself that. because that is what a human being is, a magical animal of the goddess. But what makes us that way? What is the basis, really, of our exceptional status in her dreaming? Well, it's quite simple, my friends. Only the human animal, by the combination of its first and second attention, can access the intentional syntax in the organic light. And she knows it. She knows it because she designed it that way. And so what I did on Infinity Ridge was set up a ritual to access the intentional syntax in the mind of the planet itself. Because if I am going to place a spell into the human subconscious, as stated in the intention of the ritual, I can only do that by stating the intention before her and to her. Do you see? That is how I commanded her. I commanded her by stating my intention openly and inserting it into her intentional syntax. Or, to put it more simply, I told her what I wanted to do with my intention and converged it into her intention so that she could accomplish what I intend to do. So while we were up there together on Infinity Ridge, the four of us, I had the privilege and the pleasure to say to the Pachamama medicine woman and her consort and to Kundri, who played my apprentice in this adventure, I had the opportunity to say the one single truth that you need to know to really own what it means to be a magical animal of the goddess. That of all the other animal species, you are that species who can access her intentional syntax. And planetary tantra is the instruction she herself gives to the human animals so that they can do exactly that. So that is what I did, and you know how I did it. And you also know when I did it, because I could only do it when I did it. You see, the golden seam in the organic light is bordered on each side by something like a fine line of silver beads. What does that signify about the seam? Well, the line of silver beads is connected with the orbit of the moon. You know, the moon is related to the element of silver, isn't it? And although quicksilver is mercury, silver is related in an occult way to the moon. And you could say that one border or one line of silver beading is the moment that the edge of the moon crosses the horizon. And the second line of silver beading is the moment that the edge of the moon departs from the horizon as it rises. And between those two moments, the human animal has access to the intentional syntax of the Aeon Sophia. And only during that moment. So the kind of rite that I performed this weekend has that specific and rigorous requirement. The cording must be set up in advance. Part of the cording is done to the point where a particular and specific device is added to the cording. And that device then is inserted into the ritual. With saliva, the moistening of the cord, and with the precise syntax of the ritual expressed in sub-vocal language at the exact moment that the moon is rising, the moment between the two borders of silver beading. So, there you go. With that said, come to 45th minute of this briefing. I'd like to turn in the next half hour or so to the subject of Lydia's vow. Now, I don't know if you've read Lydia's vow, but you can find it on metahistory.org if you go to Lydia's well. And it's short, and it describes the vow that Lydia took in 341 AD, along with seven other members of the mystery cell of Antioch, to the effect that one member of that cell, one member of the eight, they didn't know who it would be, in some future time, would break the vow of silence of the mysteries. And so Lydia's vow was to break a vow. But that vow had to be broken when it came to the moment in the culpa, when it came to the moment in human history, when nothing is sacred anymore, when everything that appears to be sacred or everything that is claimed to be sacred can be faked, when all spiritual, previous spiritual practices and principles become either obsolete or fraudulent. And at that moment, there must be something that cannot be perverted. There must be something that cannot be violated. And so Lydia's vow involves, you could say, it involves a dare. And in fact, Lydia's vow is a dare to anyone who reads it. And this is the dare. I dare you want to see the organic light. I dare you to want to see it. I don't dare you to see it. I dare you to want to see it. And of course, that dare couldn't be in the world had it not been revealed what is the organic light and how to see it. So Lydia's vow was completed. I can assure you of that. And some of you, I know, some of you know that already. And you hold the implications of what that means. So where do we go from here? Well, you know, my mind goes back to the immediate months at the end of 2007 and into 2008. Early in that year when I met Emma, and that whole story unfolded through 2007. And then into 2008, with the dawn of Planetary Tantra beginning in May of 2008, that is about 5 years ago to this day. And it's just about 5 years ago that Lydia's vow was written and posted on metahistory.org. And I can recall vividly, during those years after the book came out, Not in His Image, that I pondered to myself what to do with the disclosure of the organic light to the world at large. What kind of proposition is this? And what kind of dare is this? And how to handle it? How to handle it? Now, already before those years, 2007, 2008, I had, let's say, attempted to play the Hierophant and to show some other human animals who were participating with me in a shamanic seance how to see the organic light. But I didn't succeed. Now, I didn't try it with many because I didn't have many opportunities. And I have not had many opportunities from that moment until now. But I've succeeded in showing the organic light to 4 human animals, all women. And of those 4, interestingly, only one is still in contact with me. Now, what we can either refer from that, what you can infer from that, I don't really know. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because contact with me is just like contact with any other human person, right? Any other guy walking around the planet. As Emma told me once when we were having a drink in Aventa, you know? You're just like any other guy walking around the planet, she said. And it's true in a way, I am. And so you could say that these 3 no longer have any contact with me because of something that transpired between me and them, me and her, you know, on the human level, in the ordinary sense. But that leaves you wondering about something, doesn't it? Leaves you wondering how anyone who could have had the opportunity to be brought to the organic light and therefore have the most sublime privilege possible to the human animal would choose A, no longer to have anything to do with the animal who brought them to that experience, and B, which is even wilder, even far, far wilder, no longer have any interest in repeating the experience. Well, I was very troubled by that, as you can imagine. And, of course, I can pass it off easily and just say, you know, there's a choice between the magic and the mundane in this world. And some people prefer the mundane. What can I say? But at a deeper level, I knew there was another lesson here. And I knew it was a lesson that I must learn if I am to be the one who fulfills Lydia's vow going forward. It's something about the initial conditions, isn't it? The initial conditions were not right. In the 4th case, the initial conditions were right. And so in the 4th case, I led a human animal to encounter the organic light. And that human animal is now dedicated with deathless intent to that experience and to the repeating of that experience. And that is as it should be. That is success. But still, even with this success, so you could say that the Nahual now has an apprentice for instruction by the light. Even with that success, I was still troubled because I knew that there are other conditions that needed to be completed, but I didn't know what they were until Saturday on Infinity Ridge. Or more precisely, after that afternoon and evening on the ridge, in the debriefing process, I came to understand something for the first time. And I'm going to tell you exactly what it is, because it is so fantastic that I can't keep it to myself. This is what I call the new apoptia. In Not in His Image, in the chapter entitled Schools for Coevolution, I describe the apoptia in this way. Quote, "The apoptia, seeing aided by the Hierophant, was carefully gauged to meet the capacities of the supplicant. The autopsia, direct and independent seeing of the organic light, came in its own time to those who had trained their powers of attention for it. The epiphany of the organic light induced a soft rush of somatic intensity that saturated the witness with bliss and brought attention to pitch-perfect lucidity. In the mysteries, mystae who had steadily beheld the light were welcomed into the company of the initiated with the benedictory greeting, 'A kid, thou hast fallen into milk.'" Now that passage describes the apoptia, which is the showing by the Hierophant to the neophyte of the organic light. And it describes the autopsia, which is the experience of seeing it without being shown, without being told how to see it. Now I pondered long and hard what to do, how to recreate, how to re-represent, how to stage, if you will, the apoptia to those who might come to me following the publication of Not in His Image and tell me that they wanted to encounter the organic light. And I never arrived, just thinking about it and pondering it over, I never arrived at a satisfactory solution. But on the ridge, this weekend of May 2013, the solution created itself. What the solution required and what it shall require in the new apoptia is 3 moments of heightened awareness. In the first moment, that was the moment a few days ago, the Hierophant instructs a neophyte who has already been taken to the light how to call the light. Remember, you see the light, the organic light, but you can also call the light using the sound of the fishes. Now, the sound of the fishes is the one element of this Gnostic Telestic practice that I will not reveal on the internet or in any way other than first person. All the rest is open. All the rest is free. All the rest is as clear and accessible as the sky above your head. But this is a particular intimate action of teaching and transmission. And so I sat beside, we were sitting, we weren't standing, interestingly. Next time we'll stand. Sitting on the hillside in Infinity Ridge with the apprentice to my right, and behind us, about 6 feet behind us, the Pachamama medicine woman and her apprentice. Four Gaian sorcerers on Infinity Ridge. And the Nawal, before the witness of the two guests, instructed the apprentice to call the light with the sound of the fishes, and so demonstrated how it is done. And the apprentice had the pleasure of demonstrating her command of the organic light to these witnesses. That is the first step in the new apoptia. Second step is the session that occurs with the same four participants. And in this step, the apprentice stands in front of the group, and the Nawal stands between the two other participants. And as the apprentice performs the autopsy, that is to say, seeing the organic light through her own powers of attention and calling it with the sound of the fishes, the Nawal, flanked by the two other neophytes, observe how she does it. And the Nawal describes what she is doing as she does it. And the Nawal performs the apoptia for those two at the same time that the apprentice performs the autopsy. Then comes the third moment. There are three moments, and three moments only, in the new apoptia. And that is the moment when the Nawal stands with the two apprentices who observed the autopsy and performs the apoptia with them, so that they reach the status of the apprentice who demonstrated this process in the first step. And then it goes on from there, and it goes on from there, and again, and it is repeated again and again. And this is the simple method of the new apoptia, the showing of the organic light. And that method was not invented by me. I did not sit down and figure it out. I did not think it through. I did not discuss it for 1 second, either with Kundry the apprentice or with the two other participants. It designed itself and it revealed itself in the power of her magic on Infinity Ridge. And this is Planetary Tantra. So as you take that in, you can understand that in this instance, in this example of Gaian Tantra, that the Nawal acts the role of the Hierophant in the mysteries. Because the Hierophant was the one who showed Phanes the sacred thing, Hieros, or Hiera. And what is the sacred thing? What is the most sacred thing in the world? So, where do we go from here? Well, I think it's pretty fantastic that this event of the emergence of the new epoptia occurred at the moment of twilight, on a day when Venus and Jupiter were setting in the horns of the bull. As I said, in March of 2012, that same conjunction took on a spectacular look in the western sky, and the whole world was stunned. But what occurred a few days ago was a fleeting and subliminal event. It was not an event that came or will ever come to the attention of the world at large, is it? But it's the same event. The same event enacted in a different way. And while I can say that the event of the March of 2012 was a magical moment of anticipation, a moment when we in the G&E could watch the seven sisters convene in the chamber of the Pleiades, and when we called forth the power and beauty and eroticism of the Hetaira, all that was a great expectation, a great anticipation. But what happened with the conjunction of May was a fulfillment. And the meeting of Venus and Jupiter, of Medicine Woman and the Turtan, was a meeting that never occurred before on this planet. A meeting of the past and the future. A meeting of the shamanism, the best distillation of the highest and purest shamanic practices of this planet from South America, from the realm of the Native American Indians, from Africa, from Egypt. The distillation of all those shamanic traditions carried in the body of the Pachamama medicine woman met the body of the Nahual of Infinity Ridge. And there arises the shamanism of the future. It is really the shamanism of the future, planetary tantra. But it's here now, and it's up and running. And the new epoptia is defined. Now I realize that it raises many questions. There are still questions that arise naturally, of course, regarding accessibility, regarding the conditions for arriving at this experience. And also, I may say, questions that concern the necessity of vetting. So I would bring all that to your minds and have it percolate in your minds as it does in mine right now. So off and on in the coming talks, I'll return to the subject of Lydia's vow and return to investigate further and clarify as far as I can the conditions that pertain to the availability of this experience. But one thing is certain, and you can celebrate with me. If you can, sob with gratitude, as Kundry did. One thing is certain, that now that the method is known, the Mistai will come. They can only come if there is a method for them to come to. So it's a most exciting moment in planetary tantra, and needless to say, a turning point in the G&E in more than one respect. Here, at midnight, on the 29th of May, I'll conclude this briefing. But I intend to pick it up again soon and to continue briefings as regularly and rapidly as I can as we move into this stall. You know, in the past that I've had the tendency to go under during a stall, I don't think it will happen this time, my friends. And I'll tell you why. Because there is support for the NAV and support for the Turton. And it's present in flesh and blood, which is the kind of support that I need. And with this support, I can handle more. And so I'm confident that I will be able to continue the briefings at a good cadence during the stall we're now entering. Thank you all for your attention, your dedication, your love, your mischief, and all the other delights that you bring into my life. And I wish you all safe passage.